Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Luma Mufla is the founder of Fuji's Family, with schools now in Georgia and Ohio, and an expanding footprint bringing educational equity to refugee resettlement communities across America. Her TED Talk on educational justice for refugee families has been viewed more than 1.7 million times. Luma's new book is Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. Follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Luma_Mufla. Coming up, we'll talk about what it's like being dropped into a classroom when you don't know English, what supports we should provide to students who are refugees, and how we can focus on the assets that refugees bring to our schools and our society.
When you can dream in two languages, you're completely bilingual. That's an asset. You know, we've had kids that were told in their previous schools that they were stupid because they don't know English. You know, when you ask them, hey, how many languages do you know? And some of them know six or seven. And you're like, you're not stupid. Like, most of this country knows one language, right? That's the way teachers should be talking to their students. It's like, no, look at what you've done. And then really highlighting what their parents have done and sacrificed to get here.
But first, Luma, how did you get involved in refugee justice?
For me, it's personal. I came to the United States when I was 18. I was born and raised in Jordan, came to college, and my senior year, I applied for asylum. I'm gay. You can get the death penalty in parts of the Middle East for being gay. So I knew that was going to be my only option. When I received my asylum, I lost my home, my family, but I had my freedom. For a long time after graduation, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I kept trying to prove to my parents I could make it on my own, you know, live the American dream, but it was really hard because I felt so isolated. And then six, 7 years after graduation, I was driving to a Middle Eastern grocery store, missed my turn back onto Ponce de Leon in Atlanta, ended up in an apartment complex, and I saw some kids playing soccer, and they were playing the way I grew up playing. They had rocks set up as goals, raggedy ball, no coaches, no parents, just for the love of the game. It reminded me of home. I sat in my car watching and then grabbed a soccer ball. I was a club coach at the YMCA at the time. And the rest was history. The boys wanted the ball. I wanted to play. That's the most universal language out there, is soccer or football.
Yeah. And you were pretty good at it. It sounded like that's what was a door opener. That and also having a really good soccer ball in great condition versus what they were playing with.
Yeah, I think it was that. And then when I would pronounce their names, I would say it the right way without an accent. And it would be a shock to them. Like, how are you pronouncing our name correctly? And then that bond of like all of us having left our homes under different circumstances. But there's also that bond that is really powerful.
Yeah. And it sounds like your family history has that as well, that your family didn't originally come from Jordan, did they?
No, my mom's family came from Syria. So they fled during the first Assad regime. My grandmother had packed up her children, five of them. She was pregnant with her sixth at the time, drove to neighboring Jordan. My grandfather had refused to leave, thinking it would blow over, just like most conflicts in the Middle East. And it didn't. And he ended up joining the family a few months later after his factory was seized by the government and his brothers went missing.
Could you call that generational trauma at that point? I mean, hearing the stories of what your family went through and then just this universal trying to find a home. I would imagine coming to America as you did, granted, you're not leaving a war situation the same way, but still that feeling of displacement is pretty universal, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's generational, like from my grandmother to then me. You know, my mother for the longest time wouldn't say she was a refugee. I think to this day doesn't say it, even though by any definition she was. And it is, it's like when you're forced from home for whatever reason, whether your country doesn't want you or your government hates you or you're being used as disposable life, it's tough. It's tough to leave and then find a place where you can say, this is home.
Yeah, when you met the children who were playing soccer, how did you take that relationship that you'd established with them and turn that into advocacy for children who are refugees?
So the kids I met were originally from Afghanistan, Liberia, and Sudan. Sudan speaks Arabic, Afghanistan Farsi with Arabic undertones, I guess. I'd like to tell you there's a playbook. I had this grand plan. This is what was going to happen, but it was playing with the kids and then starting a soccer team. I knew how to coach soccer and then getting to know the kids and their families. They were very generous with their time, with their meals. Every night I was invited someone's home for dinner and got to learn about what they were facing here. And I felt I was 1 or 2 degrees removed from that. You know, I had an excellent education growing up. My parents sent me to British and American schools. And I believed all schools in America were like the State Department run private school I went to in Jordan. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case. My players were coming here, being plunked into the age appropriate class with no support and expected to do grade level work with maybe 1 or 2 hours of ESL. And it just felt not logical. I tried starting like helping them with their homework and realized that was a band-aid solution. Like I was basically doing the homework for them.
Yeah.
And then I said, if these were my kids, what would I do? I said, I would put them in the best school I could that could serve their needs. There wasn't one. I couldn't afford private school. So it was actually cheaper to hire a teacher and get 6 kids to enroll in a program in a church basement that was donated to us. And it just grew from there. Wow. I think it was the outrage and anger combined with some optimism of what can be done and should be done.
I think about the needs that children have when they come from another country, when they're fleeing Afghanistan or now Ukraine. We're going to start seeing that here pretty soon, where you've got different levels of education. I think there's an acronym for that. S-Life. Students with limited or interrupted formal education.
Yeah.
So how do you determine at what level they are academically? And then you need the interpretation support, because if you're speaking Farsi and there's no one who speaks Farsi, you know, you can't just, as you said, plunk them in the middle of the classroom and expect that they'll understand what's going on. When you were a kid, you were in a class in an English-speaking environment. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you? Just to be expected to perform, I guess, for lack of a better word, when you don't know the language.
I mean, I'd spoken only Arabic until the age of 6. And then my parents put me in a British school. It was like, I felt mute and deaf. Like I couldn't communicate. I think there's one other Arab kid in my class, but we were seated opposite ends, so we couldn't talk to each other in our language. But the beauty of it is everybody was from somewhere else. And for most of the students there, English was their second language, even though they had literate families, no disrupted education. For me, I thrived in classes that didn't require academic language. So music, the arts, athletics. I learned more in those classes than anything else, and I would look forward to them. Like I could sing, didn't understand a word of what I was singing, but I could sing. And those are so essential for all kids, because they're other languages of expression and you learn better because they're multisensory. So not only benefits English language learners, it benefits everyone.
Would you say that there was more grace in that school when you were a kid because there were students from all over?
Possibly there was more grace. There also, it was English only, complete immersion. No other languages were used. I remember coming home with headaches, like pounding headaches. And I guess they call that the silent period where you get really quiet and you're trying to digest and your brain starts rewiring. But I still remember it like years later, like sitting in that kindergarten classroom, not understanding a word. I don't know if we were more graceful back then than we are now. Probably. We don't seem to be very graceful these days.
Yeah, because I'm thinking, what could be done for students who are refugees because they are in a completely different environment? What sorts of supports? I mean, yes, interpretation would be great, but I think about the reality of what public schools have in terms of resources. There's a district that's near Seattle where I believe it's 167 languages are spoken in just one school. What would you recommend?
We do English only. We say English is our first language, soccer is our second language. We have music and the arts every single day, athletics every single day. They are as core to our schedule and our model as math and English are. And so I would say using instruction that focuses on multisensory aspects and learning and see where kids are thriving and what they look forward to. I mean, you ask most people now, like, what got you through school? They're either going to say, hey, my drama club, band, or the athletic team they're on. They're not going to say their English teacher. They're not, you know? And so why aren't we doing more of that, where those are the places where kids are thriving and engaged, instead of cutting that left and right or making it select, like only people who try out can make it or afford it? It's like, no, every kid should be doing it.
It makes so much sense. My son, AJ, he's 12 and he is in a STEM lab class where he does some coding, he does some robotics, he does some building of machines. And that has been just a lifeline for him. Yeah. He had that this year for the very first time. And for the very first time, he's felt successful in school.
And he loves going to school now, right?
Or at least he doesn't hate it. And so he always has the STEM lab as sort of the carrot at the end of the day, because it's his last class. Yeah. So he can look forward to that every single day. Yeah. How do you find that thing that lights up a student, especially if they do come from these varying backgrounds?
It's what commonality. So music is universal, visual arts is universal, acting is universal, building is universal. So anytime our science classes use building, kids want to have it relate to why they're learning it. An algebra formula doesn't necessarily click. Geometry clicks when you explain it in terms of space in a soccer game, right? Mm-hmm. What's the practical use for it? Let them practice it and try it. You have to listen to the community. You have to observe kids. Not come in with our own assumptions and saying, well, this is what worked for me 20, 30 years ago, so we're going to design a school like that. Like, let's listen to how kids are learning, what they have access to, and how we can make their learning better than ours, instead of, well, we're going to just copy what we've been doing for 60, 70 years.
What about mental health? Because I think about the journey that these kids have had. Whether they're, again, depending on the background, I just think of Somalia, for example. We have refugees from Somalia in my area, certainly Afghanistan, we're seeing more and more coming, and soon Ukraine. How would you provide the mental health supports to make sense and cope with and manage the trauma that they've come from?
This one's a little tricky because traditional mental health is not embraced by Eastern communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're sharing everything about your life with someone you don't know. We've had parents say they're going to pull their kids out, want to recommend a counselor. So we've been training our athletic coaches, so our soccer coaches, to give those supports to the kids and their families. So someone that has a shared lived experience that is, in their eyes, successful, has made it, has integrated, but will not judge home cultures or practices because you're one of them, right?
Right.
And then kids, like, we have three different social structures in our school. So each kid belongs in an academic cohort that they go with the entire day. Then they're all part of a soccer team, which sometimes has overlap from their academic cohort, but sometimes not. And that's single gender. And then we have house systems. So similar to Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling did not invent that. So it's across age groups and it's intentionally diverse. So kids are interacting with others who are maybe 2 or 3 years ahead of them. They might have common faith. They might have a common ethnic background, or they just might have the common refugee immigrant experience, which is powerful. And so, you know, and sometimes on that field, you're running around, you're playing, and you don't have to explain yourself, right? Everybody on that team is like you. And you need those spaces where you're around people that are like you, where you don't have to explain yourself to anyone, right?
Yeah, you're right about the first time you went to a refugee camp when you were 8 years old. It was a Palestinian refugee camp outside of Amman. Mm-hmm. What did that feel like for you?
It felt really weird, like something so close, literally in our own backyard. Already at 8 years old, I was judging people who were different than me. They look different. I don't know if you've been to camps in abroad. They're not a place anyone wants to live. It's dense. There's no running water necessarily. That one did not have most of the living conditions weren't built out completely. So tents, scarcity of food, people not treated with any dignity. And so even as a kid, I was like, I was scared of playing with people who were not like me. I thought I was better than them. Mm-hmm. Like looking back at that, I was like, how is it 8 years old? This is how I felt. It took my grandmother like pushing me. She always felt she needed to connect to the refugee experience so she would not forget. And so when she took me and I was like hanging on to her and she's like, go play with the kids. And I was like, I'm not going to play with the kids. I don't know these kids. And she's like, go and don't come back till you've played with them. And she's just like big woman, like big teddy bear. Mm-hmm. But when she gets stern, you're like, okay, I got to do what she says. And I did. And eye-opening experience for me. And there's not much I could do in Jordan, even at 8 or even now, but like the United States gives you so many opportunities to do better, to provide maybe a softer landing place for those who have fled their homes.
Yeah. One thing your grandmother said to you was, don't feel sorry for refugees, believe in them. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah. It stuck with me till today. And we use it a lot with our staff. So many people feel sorry and they feel like they're not capable of it. Well, they've gone through all this trauma, right? And they look at our community as a deficit, right? Like, oh, we got to translate these questions. Look at all their needs. Look at all this. Instead of flipping it and what are the assets? What does someone who has been forced from their home, coming to a new country, learning a new language and culture, and leaving their entire family back home, like what kind of strength does that person bring? And you capitalize on that. And so start looking at your families and community with what they bring to the table, not what they don't have, and expect the best for them. There's been so many times where I've met with people in the space and they're like, well, it's better than what they had. We should never say that. We should say, is that the best you can offer? Is this the best you can give? Instead of it's better than what they had. I mean, that's such a low bar.
I want to go back to strengths there for a moment because it probably couldn't hurt to name some of those. And the one that jumps out at me more than anything else is resilience. Yeah. And if you can leave a situation that is unstable and your life is in danger and you have to just uproot everything you know and then start over, what can be more resilient than that?
Yeah. And I mean, that's the kind of person you want to work in your business, right? And friends with your kids, like true character for someone to survive that, continue doing it and be hopeful. All the kids and families I've met are not broken. When they get here, they're hopeful and optimistic and still believe in this country in some ways more than most American-born students and adults.
Yeah. What are some other assets that people bring? I would imagine the dual language, that's a big thing.
And the bilingual brain, right?
Yes.
And the bicultural brain, like being able to navigate different cultures. Was it when you can dream in two languages, you're completely bilingual? That's an asset. You know, we've had kids that were told in their previous schools that they were stupid because they don't know English. You know, when you ask them, hey, how many languages do you know? And some of them know 6 or 7. And you're like, you're not stupid. Like most of this country knows one language, right? That's the way teachers should be talking to their students. It's like, no, look at what you've done. And then really highlighting what their parents have done and sacrificed to get here, you know, because I feel the parents are not embraced and respected by communities because they're other. And then kids get embarrassed or ashamed and say, like, no, it's my mom and look at what she can do for me.
And going back to my son, who's 12, and as he sees children who do come from a refugee background coming into his school and as he interacts with them in the community, what would you say to students that are, or children who are my son's age or even a little bit older or younger about how to interact with and view other children who have been refugees?
Kids have it easier than adults. They're less judgmental. They're more curious, right? They'll ask any question and it's out of good intent, you know, not fear. Like I've seen my 7-year-old daughter have conversations that adults can't have with those who are different from her. And what I would say is like, have conversations, ask questions, listen, right? So you're not the only one asking, that they're getting to ask you. that this is a reciprocal relationship. Teach them about things that are unique to America and learn about things that are unique to their culture, right? Share a meal. Invite family over for Thanksgiving. I'll guarantee you, you're going to be invited to their house next because that's the way the cultures work. Like, it's those simple steps of how do we welcome people? And it's sometimes like, just treat people the way you want to be treated. You know, if you've left your country, what is it that you want your neighbor to do? Same with your schoolmate, right? Like, what do you want that kid to do? And you basically want someone to smile at you and just maybe kick a ball or build a bridge or a computer or something, right?
What about educators? What would you say to educators who might be listening to this, who have students who have been refugees?
I would tell them to look at their students as assets, look at everything they bring to the table and capitalize on that and talk to the students about it and acknowledge it as something great, not something of weakness. Create community in your classroom where everybody shares and listens to each other. I feel we've gotten like this. We don't want to listen. We don't want to talk. We're scared of offending. And kids know how to talk to each other and communicate with each other. And then you're a teacher. You might not know everything, like learn. You might not know everything about the Afghan conflict, right? That's an opportunity for your student to teach you. There's nothing more powerful than having a student teach you. And acknowledge that you don't know everything, because then you create a learning environment in your classroom.
If you could change our educational system and you were in charge, say you were the Secretary of Education for the US and you had no budgetary constraints, what would you do?
Wow, that's like giving me the golden ticket here, right?
That's right.
I'd create smaller schools. Our schools are too big. You need to know everyone's name in the building. We're so consumed in such places, whether it's social media, where we don't have intimate human connection, and schools need to have that, where they're learning, where class sizes are smaller, where kids can have more hands-on experiences and learning, or we test out and pilot new courses every year. We're not, hey, this is it. And then we tweak it a little bit and say, that's innovation. That's not innovation. Like, let's really throw everything out and bring students in to help us design what school would look like. I think it would be fascinating to get your son, my daughter, my students to sit down and tell us, hey, how would you start your day, right? How can we make it fit into a school day? To really focus on community, not just academics. How do you create community in a building? How do you engage everyone? How do you make sure everyone has access to everything and not make excuses why they don't, and then don't do it at all? And just try it. It doesn't have to be perfect right away. Like, we're so scared of trying something. What's the worst thing that could happen? We're not going to get worse results than what we have right now. They're terrible, right? And so we should be trying things and really engaging students and communities, and as much as possible, trying to walk in their shoes. So a kid who's fled their country needs something very different than a kid that was born and raised here. Yet we plug them into the same square and it doesn't work. And everybody should have options for good schools, not determined by our property taxes. That's not how it should be.
Luma Mufle's new book is Learning America, One Woman's Fight for Educational Justice for Refugee Children. Follow her on Twitter and Instagram at Luma_Mufle. Luma, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.